This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our hope and ambition to move beyond just talking about Christian teaching to living the life of Christ. Well, one thing that makes this difficult is all the unbelief around us. Some people look at the world and say, this kind of just happened. Well, one person who used to believe that way and changed his mind is our guest today, Hugh Ross. He's the founder and the president of Reasons to Believe. We've had him on a few times before. And Hugh, you wrote the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And that was one of our several interviews we've done with you. And this book now that we feature and give this as a title to our program, Improbable Planet. This is somewhat of a sequel to that book, would you say?
Yeah, it is, in the sense that we focus on the history of our planet, the universe that gave rise to the planet, and what has to happen on the planet in order for billions of human beings to live on it at one time with the technology that they can hear and respond to the gospel message of redemption through the work of Jesus Christ.
So what motivated you? You've written a lot of books. What motivated you to write this particular book?
Well, it was a year-long Bible study I did where I recognized that every major creation text in the Bible consistently links the doctrine of creation with the doctrine of redemption, and also biblical texts have made the point that God began his works of redemption before he created anything, which led me to conclude that means that every component of God's creation must have a redemptive purpose. So then I spent about a three-year period going through the scientific literature to see if that was borne out, and was amazed to discover that's exactly what's going on, that literally every part of the universe, every component, every historical event, likewise every historical event in Earth's history, and every life form that has ever existed on planet Earth, each of those items plays a crucial role in making possible the redemption of billions of human beings in a short window of time.
Fascinating, fascinating. It's like a big storyboard for the whole world to read, if they will open their eyes, isn't it?
Well, it's also the key to understanding science. For me, it gives me a model to understand why science looks the way it does, and that the way to really foster scientific discovery is in the concept or in the construct of redemption.
Now, scientists often are trying to find life on other planets, and we know Millions was put into a big project several years ago. I don't think they've had much luck, but what's behind that? What's the drive?
Well, what's driving it is we look at planet Earth and we realize that the origin of life happened as early as the laws of physics would permit, and it was an instantaneous event, which has led my colleagues to presume that the origin of life must be an easy step, even though we've not found all the building blocks for the origin of life. And therefore, they presume that the universe has got to be filled with life. But what we now recognize is it's impossible to have human beings or the equivalent unless the origin of life happens as early as possible and it's an instantaneous event. We wouldn't be here unless the origin of life was very early. And therefore, the probability may not be high at all. It may be extremely low. And we've written other books where we make the point that the origin of life is impossible from a naturalistic perspective. But the other thing driving it is what's called water habitable zone. I mean, you'll see in the web articles that our galaxy alone might have as many as 40 billion habitable planets. But that number comes from the presumption that if you've got liquid water on a planet, it's habitable. Water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe, so it's not a big surprise that we're finding lots of planets where liquid water could conceivably exist. But as I write an Improbable Planet, you'll see it in Chapter 7, 9 different habitable zones are necessary for a planet to be truly habitable. So, for example, it's not only important for a planet to be in the water habitable zone, it must be in the ultraviolet habitable zone, in the atmospheric electric field habitable zone, to name 3 of the 9. And the only planet we know of that resides in all 9 habitable zones is the planet you and I are sitting on. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't want to restate the point you're making in case someone missed it. The first point about life on other planets, tell me if I'm right here. Another way to state it is it's highly improbable, if not impossible, that life could have just formed on planet Earth through evolution, given the short lifespan on planet Earth and what it would take to create human beings with their genome and so forth. So the scientists who refuse to believe there's a God think there must somehow life must have been imported from outside. That's kind of the argument, right?
It is the argument, but everywhere else we look, you got the same problems. I mean, for example, the building blocks, ribose, which is necessary for DNA and RNA, it's found nowhere outside a biological system, either on Earth or anywhere else in the universe. So going somewhere else doesn't really help. And that's just one of several building block molecules that's completely missing outside of living systems. Now, having said that, I've been on record since the 1980s of predicting we will find the remains of life on every solar system body. But that's because life is so prolific on planet Earth that when meteors strike the Earth, a lot of Earth life gets exported throughout the solar system. And so, for example, there's 20,000 kilograms of Earth soil on every 100 square kilometers of the moon. And within that soil, you're going to find the fossils of Earth's life.
That is fascinating. I've not heard anybody argue that point before. So then if asked the question, is there a chance there's life on another planet like ours out there? How do you answer it?
Well, we're talking outside of our solar system. Yeah, the probability is zero from a naturalistic perspective. I mean, yeah, our planet can export life throughout the solar system, but not interplanetary space. And as we look elsewhere, we've yet to find any star that would be a candidate to have life on a planet orbiting it, at least advanced life on a planet orbiting it. And we've yet to find a planet outside of our planetary system that resides in all 9 habitable zones. So everywhere we look, we see hostile conditions for life, except for Earth.
Yeah, so if there were life, would we be able to detect it outside of the planet Earth?
Well, my colleagues actually are developing techniques to do that very thing. That, for example, if you've got a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, that in most cases would be a signature for photosynthetic activity, especially if you see that oxygen combined with an unusual amount of methane. And so we're looking for chemical signatures of life, but the really only definitive signature would be isotope ratios. You know, life favors certain isotopes of carbon and sulfur and nitrogen over other isotopes. And so we see that, then we really do have the signature for life.
So, Hugh, I'm going to jump us back as we look at your book. Now, I want to encourage our listeners to get a hold of Improbable Planet, How Earth Became Humanity's Home. And as we look now beyond just what's out there, really the lack of life, let's think about the incredible, really, the improbability that there would be life in its advanced form here on planet Earth. What do you see, if you take all the study you've done through these years and all of your reflection, Hugh Ross, PhD, what is the thing that amazes you most about human life on planet Earth?
Well, what amazes me is that our little tiny planet can support 7 billion of us living here at one time. And what you'll see in Chapter 15 of Improbable Planet, that's only possible if we're living in an ice age cycle, where the amount of ice coverage on our planet cycles with a period of 100,000 years from 10% coverage to 23% coverage. And you can only get that many people living on the planet if you're in an interglacial, where the interglacial follows the most severe ice age in the cycle, and where 4 different cycles in Earth's orbit and rotation line up in a very unusual way to give us a 9,000-year window of extreme climate stability. And it's because of that extreme climate stability and the water from the last ice age and the nutrient dust from the last ice age that we can grow enough food to feed billions of human beings and create a food surplus where we can separate a large fraction of our population to do engineering and science and thereby develop the technology that we enjoy today.
As an astronomer, when you look out at the stars and contemplate the planets and the galaxies out there, what also, I want to ask the same kind of question, what has really grabbed your attention? Is it the shape of our galaxy? Is it, you know, things that just seem so improbable that they could have in the end allowed for life, yet so necessary?
Well, when I look at our galaxy, it's got extremely symmetrical spiral arms It's got two dwarf galaxies, a large and small Magellanic clouds, that funnel in just the right amount of extragalactic gas and dust to sustain that extreme spiral arm symmetry with very few spurs and feathers. And as we look elsewhere, we see billions, hundreds of billions of galaxies. But ours is the only one that has the features that would allow for advanced life. And then as I looked at our moon, I realized, I thought there's a chapter in the book on what formed the moon. But the amount of fine-tuning design you need to make the moon so that advanced life is possible is so spectacular that non-believers who've been developing these lunar models are saying there's way too much fine-tuning design. And they actually had a time where they redid all their models trying to get rid of some of that design. They wound up with much more and wrote a series of articles in the British journal Nature where they said this is causing us philosophical disquiet. It's upsetting their worldview. And you're getting the same response from what is called the Grand Tack model for the gas giant planets in our solar system, how Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune migrated in towards the sun, stopped, reverse direction, and migrated outward. But that very delicately controlled inward and outward migration gave us exactly the comet and asteroid belts that we needed to make advanced life possible. And we're living in the only planetary system that has the asteroid and comet belts that you would need for advanced life. Everywhere else, there's either no comet or asteroid belts, or comet and asteroid belts that are hundreds of times bigger. Mm. In both cases, that eliminates the possibility of advanced life.
As you and your book cover a number of the fine-tuned principles we can say that are required to bring advanced life about, you've alluded to the way even the secular astronomers and scientists are amazed at the razor-edge fine-tuning that would be needed to allow for life to exist on Earth. Can you talk about that just a little more? Give our listeners a sense of how truly improbable to impossible it is, unless there is somebody in control of all this.
Well, as I describe in the book, the last 5 years, my peers who are not believers have been redoing the moon-forming model. They've been redoing the Grand Tack model. But every time they redo it, they come up with even more design, and they come up with an even more powerful model to explain why the solar system is the way it is. And they come up with more insights why it's got to be exactly that way for billions of us to live on planet Earth at this time. And some of them are bewildered, some of them are complaining, but some of them are even saying, wow, we need to change our worldview. So I've actually seen some astronomers look at this data and say, this is not something we didn't expect, and maybe there is a mind behind it all that's fine-tuning it so that we could be here at this time.
It's a beautiful thing to hear. Okay, Hugh, hold on just a minute. We're going to take a quick station break.
Have you ever read the Bible from cover to cover? Bible in 90 Days, or B90, can make that aspiration a reality. So during the month of November 2016, we're offering all B90 Bibles, participants' guides, and leaders' DVD kits at a 10% discount. That's right, 10%. So take advantage of our B90 Thanksgiving special. You too can join thousands of others who can say, I've read the Bible in 90 days. Go to www.BibleIn90Days.org and use the coupon code B90THANKS10. That's B90THANKS, the numbers 1 and 0. B90THANKS10.
Welcome back to Beyond Words Radio. We have with us guest Hugh Ross. Dr. Ross is author of many books that really help us understand how our Christian faith relates to science, and especially the universe around us. He's a PhD with a focus on astronomy, and we're featuring his book now, Improbable Planet. So by way of example, I'm picking a random chapter. You've talked about the moon. How about the sun? What elements have come into play to allow us to be alive before this great burning ball?
Well, that great burning ball, the sun, is getting brighter and brighter as it gets older and older. And when it gets to be perfectly middle age, which it is right now, it enters a tiny time window where its luminosity stability is extremely stable and where the amount of flaring activity is extremely low. All that's crucial for advanced civilization on our planet. But the sun right now is so extremely bright that it should be impossible for any ice to be in our planet at all. And so what I describe in the book are five simultaneous miraculous tectonic events that happened 3 billion years ago, all at the same time, that transformed our planet in such a way that it cooled enough where we could have an ice age cycle. And keep in mind that for 90% of Earth's history, there's been no ice at all. And for the other 10%, there's been no cycling of ice from 10 to 20%, except for the last 0.00057 part of Earth's history. So this is the unique time in which we exist. And so unless you get North and South America coming together to make the Isthmus of Panama, unless you get Antarctica breaking off from South America and settling directly over the South Pole, and unless Greenland moves north by 1,100 miles and goes over a hot spot where it elevates from 1,000 feet above sea level to 10,000 feet above sea level, and unless India breaks off from Madagascar and crashes into India at high speed, making the Tibetan Plateau, the planet simply would not be cool enough to have an ice age cycle at that moment when the sun is at its best luminosity stability. And so God, in my opinion, has been planning all this throughout the entire history of the universe and Earth to open up this tiny time window in which billions of us could live here and have the technology where the whole world could hear the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ and respond to it. I mean, that's why God created the universe, to make possible the redemption of billions of human beings. And we're living in that time window right now.
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, when you stand at the ocean and think about its depths and how much we will never really explore, you think, wow, God made this for us. But when you look up and ponder the cosmos, it's just mind-boggling.
Well, not only made it for us, the universe and the Earth and Earth's life history screams at us that we have purpose, we have destiny, God has a plan for us. And so that's what's exciting to me about all this, is looking at creation, looking at the universe, all of nature, and saying, it's telling me why I'm here.
So when we look not up but down into the ground, searching for building blocks for DNA, RNA, and the like, what do we find there?
Well, we do see that there are natural sources for some of the amino acids and nucleosides, but not all. I mean, for example, there is no natural source outside of living systems for the basic amino acids, lysine and arginine. And you can't put together the nucleosides to make DNA and RNA unless you've got ribose sugars. And nowhere do we see a source of ribose sugars outside of living organisms or the decay products of living organisms. And if you don't have building blocks, you have no possible naturalistic model. So that's one of many pieces of evidence that the origin of life must be a supernatural event.
One of your chapters is titled Air Conditioning. Explain that one to us.
Well, there we're talking about how we can keep the planet cool when the sun is as bright as it is, and how that's been a problem for astronomers and geophysicists, what's called the faint sun paradox, how it is that the sun gets brighter and brighter, and yet our planet stays at an optimal temperature for life. And what's happening there is that God uses life to control the amount of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. So as the sun gets progressively brighter and brighter, life on planet Earth progressively removes more and more greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, which keeps the temperature on the surface of the Earth optimal for life. But what it requires is God stepping in and removing life from planet Earth periodically and replacing it with new life that is more efficient at pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And we can look at the fossil record and see that there's one of these mass extinction events followed by a mass speciation event. It happens about once every 30 million years. And if you look at the orbit of the solar system above the center of the galaxy, it moves up and down on the plane with a period of about 30 million years. So now we understand what's generating these mass extinction events. But the amazing thing is, it's exactly at the period you would need to perfectly compensate for the increasing luminosity of the sun. And only a God that has a mind that knows the future physics of the sun would know which light to remove and which new life to replace that old life that was removed.
Now, would someone look at this perhaps with a naturalistic mindset and say, you're just reading stuff into this? This is the way everything evolved. It came to be over time. And so, yes, because we happen to be in a place where life actually occurred, we can look at it and suppose this is very improbable. But that has no evidence through all that there is a God. This is just the improbable thing that happened. How do you respond to that kind of a naturalistic perspective?
Well, I would argue that it was just one fine-tuning incident. You could say, well, that's just a chance coincidence. But if you got thousands of them all lining up at the same time to make possible existence of human beings, they can't all be coincidences. Mm. This is the signature of a mind that has a plan, that knows what to do. Because if it's a random natural process, it's going to get out of sync very quickly, and the planet becomes permanently sterile. The fact that it has stayed so full of life for so many billions of years means it's got to be a supernatural creator that's very intelligent, that's controlling everything step by step.
Hugh, as a scientist, I'm sure you can look at all these new discoveries and the greater and greater evidence of the complexity of the fine-tuning required to allow for intelligent life on planet Earth, and have a sense of wonder and almost astonishment at the evidence around us that there is a God of redemption, a God who cares for us. And yet, has the trend been in a scientific community in our generation to have more atheists and fewer believers in God?
Well, there are studies that have been done that show that the percentage of research scientists that believe in God in an afterlife has been constant for the past 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 45%. What we also notice is that the percentage is much higher in the physical sciences of mathematics, physics, astronomy, and chemistry than it is in the life sciences. So in those sciences where things are simple, where you can draw conclusions with great rigor, we see many more research scientists who say, this has got to be the handiwork of God. But where things are so complex that we really can't even determine, what's actually responsible for what's going on, there you find a relatively high level of unbelief.
And so perhaps our problem in general as a society and in the realms of science is that we become so specialized. Would you suppose that if, as it used to be back in the days of Galileo and so forth, that if scientists took a broader perspective, they would be more likely to believe if they looked at all the pieces of the puzzle?
I see that all the time, that once we challenge a scientist, begin to go outside their narrow sub-discipline, and suddenly the pieces come together for them, and it causes many of them to become believers in Jesus Christ. I mean, what I frequently run into, for example, and engage people in the life sciences, they will say, well, in my sub-discipline, we got major problems with the Darwinian or naturalistic model. But I'm convinced everybody in the other sub-disciplines has got it worked out, so it must be just me and my sub-discipline. But when you show them that every sub-discipline has major problems with a materialistic model, then suddenly they say, wow, this is pervasive. I've got to change my worldview.
Fascinating. As we close here, I wonder if you could say a word to the person who sees her himself as they feel that they are quite scientific, they're deep thinkers, and they're just convinced that a person like you or like me, if I say right now publicly, I gladly say this, that I have great respect for your work, for your writings. I'm convinced that there is more evidence to say there is a God around us, even in the physical universe, than that there is not. But if someone looks with disdain on this point of view, can you give a final word to them to maybe encourage them to look a little further?
Yeah, I could. In fact, it comes from the words of the Apostle Paul in his letter to the Thessalonians. He says, test everything, hold fast to that which is good. And so I'd say, hey, if you're in a state of doubt or skepticism today, do some testing. And you know, every day, new scientific research papers are published. In fact, I maintain a blog that you can see in reasons.org called Today's New Reason to Believe, where I report on some of these emerging scientific discoveries that give us more evidence for the Christian faith. If the Christian faith is true, advancing scientific discoveries will give us progressively more evidence. But if it's false, it'll progressively show falsifications of our biblical creation model. Put it to the test and see what happens. And only takes a few weeks to be able to put it to a more rigorous test.
Well, I thank you for this time, and I want to encourage our listeners to indeed go to Reasons to Believe, not just for the blog site, but other resources. Hugh, just in quick summary, what else can they find there on your website?
Well, if they go to reasons.org, they can access all of our books and DVDs, but they'll also find tens of thousands of articles that they can read for free, podcasts that they can listen to for free, and we also take people's questions. I maintain both a Twitter and a Facebook page where people can engage us and ask their questions. And so by all means, visit reasons.org, and we have actual tools to guide you into that which most interests you.
And I'd like to say this, this is not to knock anybody out there, but there are those who have the view that the Earth is very young, and Hugh holds a viewpoint with a lot of science to support him, and I believe scripture to support him, that the Earth has quite a bit of traction on it, that there's a lot of age there. But nevertheless, and I should say, maybe Hugh say it more strongly, largely because of his viewpoint, he is convinced, and I am too, with him, that there is a God and the evidence is around us. So please do take time, get on the website, do some reading, compare viewpoints. You know, the point of argument is not really about the age of the Earth. The big issue is there a creator? And we believe there is. Hugh, thank you so much for your time, for your insights, for writing this book, and may God bless you as you continue to educate the public.
Oh, you're very welcome.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.